This is Critical Conversations, our 10th chapter, and today we're super lucky and privileged to have Dr. Peter Carter along with us. My co-host is Dar Jamail.
Great to be with you again, Robert, and great to have the show back on air. And as you said, we are extremely lucky to have Dr. Carter with us. He is a retired family physician who practiced medicine first in England, then on both coasts of Canada for almost 40 years. He now covers environmental policy for the Climate Emergency Institute, which he founded and has submitted to UN consultations on this topic. Peter is also an IPCC, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's an IPCC expert reviewer and has reviewed assessments in the past and is currently undergoing a review of their sixth assessment report. He's also co-authored the book Unprecedented Crime, Climate Science Denial, and Game Changers for Survival. Dr. Carter, thank you so much for being with us today. I want to start from your website, which is climateemergencyinstitute.com, which is a treasure trove of climate information for people looking to expand their knowledge on this critical topic. You have a section called Observed Evidence, and I want to point out this is not projections, but observed evidence, i.e. already happening. I want to just point out a few of these lowlights, if you will. Industrial greenhouse gas emissions are at an all-time high. Atmospheric CO2 is the highest it's been in roughly 20 million years. All atmospheric greenhouse gases have been accelerating since 2000. Atmospheric methane has increased 2.5 times and is now accelerating due to methane feedback emissions. There's been a dramatic increase in global concurrent droughts and heat waves. California is now in a mega drought, according to NASA. Global surface warming is accelerating. Arctic amplified warming is now 3 times that of the global average. There's a rapid decline of Arctic summer sea ice, which is in a feedback loop. There's a rapid decline in far north snow, which is also in a rapid feedback loop. There's an acceleration of Greenland ice loss, an acceleration of Antarctica mass loss, and all of Antarctica is now warming. That's just a thumbnail of a long list of things like this that you have on there.
And Peter, I don't know if you know the movie Snowpiercer or have seen it. Snowpiercer, directed by Bong Joon-ho. But Snowpiercer is an allegory about income inequality, basically. And it takes place on board a train to nowhere. And it seems to me that we're kind of on that situation right now. We're on a train that's moving incredibly fast to some precipice that we don't really understand, or at least most of us don't understand. And all of these things that Dar was talking about are things that we see out the window as this train is going along. I wonder if you could expound upon how they relate and what is it we're facing?
That's a very good analogy. Thank you. Yeah, the train left the station long, long, long ago. What I concentrate on mostly is I do a monthly record monitoring of all of the so-called climate change indicators. And thanks now for covering some of those. They're all at record highs. They're all accelerating. So a lot of people now, we have a kind of progress in the sense that sort of 18 months ago, the climate emergency was finally widely recognized. And, you know, institutions, governments, municipalities, and a lot of people, a lot of the public, if you ask them, they understand we're in an emergency. Some call it a crisis. But at the same time, as you say, we are on a train going nowhere. The last statement by excellent UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on climate was we are at the abyss. And we are indeed. It was a couple of years ago when Secretary General Guterres made a statement at a world summit that, quote, climate change is an existential threat to most life on the planet, and particularly that of humankind. So those of us who have been involved in of course, climate change for a long time, we're all aware that this is a survival issue. This has been a survival issue for a long time, a survival issue for decades for the world's most vulnerable people, populations, and the tropics and the equatorial regions. We've known this for actually decades, and now they're suffering very badly. But now it is a threat to the survival of us all, including those of us lucky enough to live in the so-called global north. Nobody is now not vulnerable to climate change. So where are we headed? It's a nasty question. It's a wicked question to provide an answer with. But I can tell you this. If our governments continue with their current policies on energy, which is pouring money into fossil fuels, and if they continue their current policies on climate, which is nothing, if the banks, the big corporate banks, continue financing the fossil fuel industry with tens of billions of dollars, which is increasing every year, then we're headed for extinction. We, particularly human beings and all mammals and sea life, it is absolutely impossible for our common future survival in the face of unprecedented levels already of atmospheric carbon dioxide, at unprecedented levels of ocean acidification. So, you know, anybody who thinks that the planet and life on the planet can somehow survive, you know, let alone suffer through all of the greenhouse gases accelerating, ocean heating accelerating, ocean acidification accelerating, ocean deoxygenation accelerating, well, they don't understand very much. So that is where our governments and our world economy and our fossil fuel industries and our banking industry have us headed. We're at the abyss, and we're headed to oblivion, and that's using a word from several years ago from the previous UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who also did a great job on climate, and years ago, he made a public statement that we were in an emergency. The frustrating, and it's more than frustrating, it's infuriating. The infuriating fact is that those same people, institutions, leaders, governments, and banking industry can almost at a flip of a switch change tracks. All governments have to do is to stop fossil fuel subsidies. They're still subsidizing fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency said that in the past couple of years, those government subsidies for fossil fuels have increased. And very recently, in the post-COVID economic recovery, there's been an absolute record all-time fossil fuel subsidies by world governments amounting to over $300 billion. So the fossil fuel industry was doing very badly. It was actually on its knees. The governments not only bailed them out, the government got them going onto the high road, which is a high road of extinction. The governments just have to. They've been told for decades they have to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. They've been promising for years. Everybody has told them that there's no justification for subsidizing fossil fuels. That International Energy Agency, the World Bank, the OECD, the IMF, and it goes on and on. So I co-authored this book, Unprecedented Crime, and that was on denial of climate change. But of course, our governments are denying climate change, right? They are in total intentional denial because for some insane, evil reason, they're continuing to fuel the fires that are burning up our future. So that's what I can say our present situation and our present future looks like.
I must say, Peter, difficult as it is to hear someone of your status, an IPCC expert reviewer, point blank say we are headed to extinction if we stay on this track that all global governments have us on. As hard as that is to hear, and it feels like a gut punch to hear that, it's also refreshing to hear someone of your stature say that, because yes, we can now acknowledge reality and the severity of the crisis that's upon us. And so now what are we going to do? And as we speak, this is right on the heels of yet another study that came out very recently, published in Nature. I'm sure you saw it. Title of the study is Accelerated Global Glacier Mass Loss in the Early 21st Century, which shows that the world's glaciers are melting faster than ever before. 31% higher rate of melting, in fact, than just 15 years ago. And this is exactly what I saw working on my book, which is aptly titled The End of Ice, and what I saw going around the world to all of these climate hotspots, that everything's bad and getting worse and accelerating. And so when someone like you, an IPCC expert reviewer, sees a new study like this, what happens in you? How does that register for you? What do you do with that when you get more information like this?
Well, in a way, I'm fortunate because I've spent my life in a career in medicine, doing a lot of emergency medicine. So I'm trained to respond to situations like this, and I respect the fact that other people aren't. Every time when I see one of these, and they are overwhelming, they're just coming at us continually, and they are scientific reports, and they're all terrible, right? I mean, they're good reports, but they're giving us some terrible information, and I keep up with them on my websites, right? And it's crazy. A friend of mine, recently, we were talking about this, a friend, very good friend in California, and we said, you know, we're in the insane asylum, aren't we? You know? But it's worse than that, because our economy and our, what I call Euro-American culture, this is not new. This goes back a long, long way. We are an economy and a culture of conquering, exploitation, oppression. And really, it's just continued to get worse and worse and worse. Now, when I read one of these reports, and it's an excellent question, firstly, my reaction is, okay, this time, you know, all the scientific organizations, all the environmental organizations, they're all going to get together, right? And they're all going to go to the rooftops, and they're going to yell, and they're going to say, hey, we are in a dire emergency. And they are going to tell our governments what to do. And this has been going on for years. And so far, really nothing. The reaction is the sort of the three monkeys. I see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil. But we are in the most evil situation that humanity has ever been in, right? And it's almost worse than evil because I say the people that are driving this, right, which is not the public. There's a lot of the public that understand. I mean, we have veganism taking off in North America. We have a lot of young people, you know, going back to the land, right, trying to become self-sufficient and stuff. No, it's who runs our society, right? So if you ask anybody who controls the society, you ask somebody in the street, they'll know it's the banks. So we have an evil economy. We have an evil setup. And so far, it's not cracking. It's not breaking. We have some good, very recent protest movements, very sincere, very well-informed, brilliantly intentioned, you know, Extinction Rebellion, Fridays for the Future, Earth Guardians, you know, the young people. I was at the Madrid conference. We were lucky. We heard Greta Thunberg early one morning. There were a few scientists there, and they were all talking about the questions that you're asking, you know, and saying what had to be done. You know, it really struck me in the heart. You know, here is this young Swedish gal. She's 18 now, I guess. She was, I think, 15 when she started to get well known. And she said everything she can say and more. Mm-hmm. And the response is nothing. Nothing. I don't know how they sleep at night. They're doing nothing but fanning the flames with more fossil fuel, exploration, and distribution.
Well, maybe the reason they're so comfortable is because despite Greta's oratory and her activism, there's something that's been lost in society where participation means learning about what's going on and getting out in the street and organizing with other people to put pressure on government.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's been a change. we don't have the activism in the same way as we used to have. The street protests, when they happen, are huge and they're great, but it has to be persistent, and it has to be within every community. In the United States, you have probably the best NGO at not only convincing people of the climate emergency, but organizing response, and that's the climate mobilization. We do have some success, but I really, really agree with you.
You mentioned earlier, Peter, you know, you kind of posed that question of, you know, what is it going to take, despite all of these scientific studies and the just amazing and extreme climatic events that are happening annually now on a regular basis. And, you know, who knows what this summer is going to look like, for example, with fires, et cetera. And you kind of posed that question of what is it going to take to crack this policy of governments, the continual subsidization of the fossil fuel industry, et cetera. You know, you've talked about this in the past. Maybe it's going to take something like a global catastrophe impacting billions of people in a very, very short amount of time.
It actually intersects with something that's in the news all the time right now, which is the border influx of refugees from Central America. And the problem is people don't recognize that the main reason that people are coming to the U.S. is because where they live, it's impossible to grow food. And so they have to move to where there is food security. But it's a short step, it seems to me, that huge swaths of the earth will be having an impact on food production, and that the food system may be the shock that will have the greatest impact on the population.
A lot of us agree with that. And there have been scientists who have been saying this for years, not only with regards to the global temperature increase years ago, when these discussions were certainly out there, wasn't accelerating as it is now, where we're in a completely, we are in a climate catastrophe state. It's not climate change, we're in climate catastrophe. You know, they were talking about the melting of the sea ice, and if the sea ice was allowed to melt away, clearly that would have a huge impact on the Northern Hemisphere. The Northern Hemisphere, of course, you know, Global North, has all the regions that are the best growing food regions. And of course, the United States in particular, the amount of food produce that the agricultural industry in the United States, which admittedly has its problems, certainly, well, I think we're probably well aware of, most of us, the amount of food they produce is absolutely phenomenal. You know, if you go and look at the numbers, it's quite incredible. But all of those food-producing regions are vulnerable. They're very vulnerable. They're in central continental areas. Then, of course, they're in California. Central continental areas heat up. Northern Hemisphere is beginning to heat up twice as fast as the southern. That's expected. Central continents heat up even more. And that's where the food production is. So our food production, the industry is so brilliant that we are still increasing our food production. But when we get hit by the extreme weather events, which are not only becoming more frequent, but they're becoming more severe, you know, heat waves in the U.S., drought in the U.S., torrential rains and floods in the U.S., there's some very, very good research that has been done. It came out just 2 or 3 years ago. And the scientists looked at, okay, what happens to the food production locally in these periods of time when extreme weather events hit? Well, they found out that food production rapidly, rapidly dropped, then slowly came back to its excellent output. Here's the surprising thing. These global north regions, including the United States, the drop was worse than even relative to what they were producing. The drop was even worse than in the low latitude regions. So inevitably, global surface warming, or global surface temperature increase, heat waves, fires, where fires are vulnerable, droughts, where droughts are vulnerable, and where they're not vulnerable at the present time, but there's some dryness around. You don't have to know anymore, do you? Right? You can't grow food because all crops have a tolerance limit. There's different kind of crops, so they have different tolerance limits. But the high one, which matters, which the IPCC has published for several years, is when you get up to 28 degrees C, just from heat alone, never mind the heat waves, never mind the drought and the dryness, right, and the lack of water, and the increased pathogens, et cetera, it goes on and on. But from heat alone, it's a tipping point for crops. They have an elasticity like ecosystems do. They can carry on, you know, they're really clever. But suddenly it's too much for them and they crash. But when our agriculture crashes, we will not be able to get it back. Now, I feel, you asked the question, okay, why is nothing being done? You know, I feel that one of the big problems is that we're suffering from a delusion that technology, science and technology can fix everything. I really suspect that this is what is in the minds of a lot of people. And I don't want to give it an excuse for policymakers, for heaven's sake, because, you know, I mean, it's a terrible crime at the minute. But I think that they do really believe that when things get bad enough, like you say, science and technology will come to the rescue. I mean, we're hearing about all these things, these fantasies, you know, various ways of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere in vast and massive amounts and sequestering it away so we'll never have to worry about it, right? So I think that's a big problem, that people are deluded into thinking that the answer will come. But they have to force the answer. They have to mobilize and they have to force our governments and our economic leaders and our banks to make the changes. And they can ring, you know, the levers, pull the levers, press the buttons, and they can change everything. I mean, we sort of all know that, right?
And that really dovetails in with, you know, we just have a few minutes left. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, which you've spoken about in the past is, and you just really addressed it, at least started to, is kind of these, I call them the half measure solutions, you know, things like, oh, let's go to net zero emissions and let's reduce CO2 emissions by 50% by 2030, or there's going to be some sort of techno fix or geoengineering or this kind of thing. And, you know, that really is, you know, that stuff actually, I would even argue, is almost more injurious because it lulls people into these false senses of security instead of doing exactly what you just said to underscore, are we at the point now where you see it as that's really the only thing we have left, is how can people effectively mobilize to force those in positions of power to do the right thing? Is that, you know, are we at this break point?
Oh, yeah, totally. We're beyond it, right? Things are so big and there's so many things happening so fast that I do think it's difficult for people to take in. You mentioned net zero, right? This is the very worst idea, now buzzword, okay, which has ever come out of climate science. And it has come out of climate science. There is a long list of scientists who have made a statement explaining in very nice scientific terms that this is nonsense. Right? But everybody is latching into net zero. So yeah, I think this is the most dangerous thing we've ever seen. Unfortunately, it's happening now. Now, that's not what the IPCC actually has said. The IPCC uses the term, okay, but the 1.5 degree C report in 2018, which was the best IPCC report. It was darn good. And it was the report that got a lot of publicity by saying we have to cut emissions 50% by 2030. So we've got 10 years, and now, as my friends in the climate mobilization say, 9 years, and we're counting, right? So 50% by 2030 is something that people really need to get. It's very, very fast, but it's also doable. But every year that we delay, and we are being delayed, every year it's getting more impossible. So there are false solutions, okay, phony solutions, sort of, you mentioned. that the most vulnerable nations have really been very good on, of course, because they know, they said we can't survive on 2 degrees C. They said it for years, and then finally we got 1.5 degrees C, thank God. But we have missed 1.5 degrees C. Our governments have missed it for us. They could have done it. When the IPCC report came out, they could have responded. My God, it got a lot of publicity. They haven't done it. They've done the opposite, exactly the opposite, in their COVID recovery plans when everybody advised them, look, we need to pour a lot of money to recover the economy in the United States and Europe and the world. Do it with all this fantastic clean energy, which we are producing, right? They didn't do it. It's like 30% clean energy, but it's 43%, right? Fossil fuel energy. So $300 billion to fossil fuel industry. We have to fight for the future. We have to fight the fossil fuel industry. But now we have to fight the corporations. We have to fight the banks. We have to fight our own governments. We have to for our very survival. And, if you love humanity, which I do, right? I've been a doctor all my life. Humanity is great, I love people. Some people not so much, but in general. And look at the wonderful, I was born into this glorious age, Kenozoic age of we've got trees everywhere and we're killing it, right? It's dying off everywhere. This really, really makes me very sad. I walk through the beautiful trees here, but very few birds, very few insects. So we the people have to get together, and there is no alternative now. I never believed I'd be saying this. I never believed I would come to the point where I had to say our governments are not ever going to do it. Our corporations, who talk green and stuff, are not ever going to do it. Our big scientific institutions, right, are not ever actually going to come out and tell governments what they have to do. Never thought we'd be in this situation. So the people have to do it.
I think we're about out of time, Peter. It's been a very challenging and interesting discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for being with us, Peter. Yes, this was an extraordinary interview, and I think leaving it on the note that it's up to the people is the perfect way to wrap this up. So thank you again, and I have a feeling we'll be speaking with you again.
Thanks, bye.
Critical Conversations is produced at KPTZ Port Townsend. Comments are welcome and should be sent to contactus@kptz.org. Music is from 1960 What by Gregory Porter.